This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Tuesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto in Chicagoland. We're going to see that sun throughout the day. A cold one, though. Kind of feels like November. A double dose of travel Tuesday. What is this real ID that we've all been hearing about? Going to need it in order to get on a plane. We'll tell you about that. Also, a new study of airline drinking water. Actually, that water you get when you're on the plane. Apparently, it's not even good to wash your hands with, much less to drink. We'll tell you about that. Also, Uber posted a quarterly loss topping $1 billion. A closer look at the ride-hailing service in our next segment as its stock is down right about 9% today. A report on job openings. The services sector out today. That's topping the latest data. Also, some news on the trade deficit. Let's get insight from Paul Christopher, head of global market strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute based in St. Louis. Paul, let's begin with the trade deficit. It shrunk a little bit. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is just part of the tariff impact. When you put taxes on imported goods, you're going to import a few less of them. So you're going to end up with a little bit narrower trade deficit. It's not really material, we think, for the overall economy. The economy is still growing at a healthy pace, although slower from last year.
And until you get a trade deal, is it really difficult to really even pay attention to any of the trends in the trade deficit? It's just some anomalies there.
There are some anomalies there. I mean, we would be concerned if we saw a trend towards a big widening once again. That would tend to weaken the dollar and hurt U.S. companies' earnings as they're repatriated from overseas. But that's not a part of our forecast right now. We would tend to look at the trade deficit as maybe one of the lesser important economic variables.
Now, would we say maybe the same reasons for the growth in the service sector?
Yeah. I mean, the service sector had a little bit of a hiccup last month, and people started to worry, ourselves included, that we might be seeing some spillover from weakness in manufacturing to services. That could spell the end of the expansion. But that doesn't seem to be the case. 1 point does not make a trend, so we're back up again. And really, consumers and households continue to drive this economy forward. We are looking for slower growth next year, but still positive, another year of economic expansion.
We have the lowest level in 18 months, job openings. Tell us about this and what it means.
Yeah, you're still seeing some slowing down in the job market. Some of that is normal late in the cycle as wages rise. Companies are less maybe inclined to put out job openings. So you start to see the job growth slow a little bit. And some of that is going to be the weight of a contraction in manufacturing all around the world, including here in the United States. So some of that is working there, too. We still think the job market looks pretty solid. Consumer confidence is kept high. Wages continue to grow, as I mentioned. So it's still overall positive for the U.S. economy and in the services and the tie-in with the job market.
For the most part, I realize it's sort of tough to too broadly generalize, but for the most part, if someone is looking for a job, are they able to find a job in this economy right now?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it depends on what your skill set is, of course. Early in the expansion, we tended to see more retail, more restaurants, hotels, mall kinds of retail jobs going. And now we're starting to see a little bit better mix of jobs, so that's a good thing to see. If that's going to continue, we'll probably need to see the economy continue to grow close to 2% where it is right now.
Thanks for the analysis. Paul Christopher, head of Global Market Strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute, based in St. Louis. Coming up, shares of Uber are taking a hit, down about 9%. That's despite a better-than-expected earnings report. Big loss last quarter for Uber. We'll get some analysis on that just ahead. Uber stock really getting hit today, down about 9%. That's despite topping analyst estimates in its quarterly report. We're joined by Mandeep Singh, senior research analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, based in New York. Mandeep, thanks for being with us. So what are we seeing here in this Uber report? Why is the stock down 9%?
Well, essentially, it's due to the lockup expiration that's coming up tomorrow. And what you're going to see is there'll be four times more float that will come on the market. So, we have seen this typically with large IPOs. Whenever there's lockup expiration, it results in, pressure on the stock, especially when the fundamentals aren't that great and investors are focused on the path to profitability of these companies.
And talk about those fundamentals, because Uber is still losing a lot of money.
That is true. So, I mean, again, you have to look at different businesses that are there in Uber. The core ride-sharing business seems to be stabilizing. In the latest quarter, they reported EBITDA margins of close to 22%. And when you look from a geographic perspective in the U.S., they seem to be doing quite well in the ride-sharing area. And I think what it tells me is there are certain pockets where they may either have to exit the market or, you know, they will continue to face more competition. And then on the food delivery side, it's really too much competition at this point of time. There are just too many players who are trying to compete for market share, and that may take a longer time when it comes to charting a path to profitability. So really, you have to look at different businesses and different geographies to figure out what's going on. But net-net, it still is a long road to profitability for them.
And Uber is as you're touching on here, Uber is complicated because everyone thinks of it as simply a rideshare business. But with freight, there's just other things going on with Uber, other growth opportunities.
That is true, and they have made a big bet on autonomous. They are spending, you know, still a lot of money on building autonomous vehicles. And so if they were to, you know, be aggressive in terms of reaching profitability, our view is they may have to exit, you know, either the autonomous business or the food delivery business and really narrow their focus on ride sharing, which is where they're seeing the best unit economics.
What they're really trying to figure out, I would imagine, is just how patient are investors going to be. It seems like there's really great expectations for what Uber could be, but it's a matter of how long people are willing to wait for them to get there.
Well, the good thing for Uber is their size and, you know, just the kind of cash they have on their balance sheet. So unlike a lot of other gig economy companies, they still have a pretty solid balance sheet. And, you know, before Uber, there are a lot of other gig economy companies that will come under pressure when it comes to just charting a path to profitability and survival. And so that way, Uber's scale and, you know, just their brand image should help them kind of ride this out while others figure out whether they can, you know, remain in this market. And once the market is consolidated, which is what we have seen with ride sharing, It will become profitable. So the reason why ride sharing is doing well is because there are only two players in North America, Uber and Lyft. So once you get to that stage in food delivery and you know, other geographies, you will see the unit economics turn much better.
Any sort of a threat for Uber? I guess Lyft would be included in this as well. In California, big push for drivers to be employees. If that goes through, seems like it would be a big cost for Uber.
Yeah, so that is a big risk in terms of, you know, what the regulators may end up doing on the wage costs and just, you know, treatment of drivers as employees. And our view is, look, Uber has to work with regulators in important cities like San Francisco and, you know, New York, and they don't have a way out because these are very important markets for them. And at the end of the day, consumers love these services, you know, so it's somewhat, you know, a course of action where they have to figure it out what's the best kind of wage dynamics are. And that's how they're going to, you know, just keep working on it. But it's not a near-term threat when it comes to, you know, their business model overall.
Thanks for the analysis, Mandeep Singh, Senior Research Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Up next, should you sign a love contract before dating a coworker?
Your daily transaction for useful information. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Office romances have always been a tricky thing, even more so in the Me Too era. Let's discuss what's happening with personal relationships in the workplace. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network here in Chicago. Tom, before we get some insight into how to handle this, I mean, let's just acknowledge there are a lot of people who meet in the workplace and want to get romantically involved.
It happens all the time. Where you tend to see it in a positive way is companies that hire lots of young people right out of college, public accounting firms, law firms, where people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week all the time, and they're all within a skills, an age range together, and they're kind of growing up together. And when you're working that many hours, and a lot of times in new cities, those are your friends and your really outlet of life. And it's a little bit different when it's a CEO or someone in the C-suite with somebody than it is with people starting out their careers that a lot of times ends in marriage.
Yeah, that was one of my questions, too. It's different if you're talking about a boss and a subordinate versus just two coworkers.
It's very different. And you have to remember that the CEO is the boss of everyone, and there is a standard. Now, he's not the first person to have it happen. And just in Chicago companies, it happened with Boeing probably 10 or 15 years ago with Harry Stonecipher, and he had to resign as well. So it's not the first time this has happened. I'm sure it won't be the last.
So what is a love contract? This is something that we've heard about in the workplace.
Yeah, they're getting to be more and more, and there's different avenues and different ideas on what that is, where people acknowledge that the company isn't at fault if a relationship doesn't work, how they will communicate to people above them if they have it. We don't know if he went to human resources and voluntarily shared it. We don't know so much about what happened in the McDonald's situation, who it was with, why, and then the human resources executive leaving the company as well. So there's probably a little bit more on this McDonald's situation than the layman can see from the reporting that we've all read so far.
Now, is there a point where you just voluntarily go in and tell HR what's going on?
Well, that's the right thing to do. The right thing is if somebody's going to date somebody that the junior person would usually resign from the company if it's a consensual situation. The rule of thumb that we've always advised in any company, client of ours or what have you, is if it's not a relationship that you're willing to tell people about, you probably shouldn't be doing it.
Thanks so much. Really, really good information. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. TSA PreCheck isn't the only service designed to help you get through airport security more quickly. And what exactly is the real ID that we've all been hearing about? We'll explore that in our Travel Tuesday segment. Also on the travel front, a study finds the water on airplanes may not even be fit for washing your hands. Advocates for people with mental health issues are demanding the city reopen clinics shut down during the Emanuel administration. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee says transcripts from the impeachment probe are being released so the American public can begin to see for themselves what happened. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 50, the NASDAQ is up 11, and the S&P is down 1 point. Oil today is up 1%. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Stocks are a little bit higher today. Let's find out what's going on. John Beaver is joining us, president of Phase 3 Advisory Services, registered principal with Royal Alliance Associates based in Buffalo Grove. John, as you're looking around Wall Street today, what do you make of what you're seeing?
Well, Cisco, it looks like the market this morning has digested Uber and Uber Eats and the ISM report, services report, and yesterday's new high, and is just kind of sitting back and relaxing. No other significant news today. So what I see is a broadening rally, which is good, perhaps some sector rotation, encouraging China trade, and lots of liquidity still from central bankers around the world.
How challenging is it, since this trade war has gone on for so long, we really don't know how it's going to end or when it's going to end. How difficult is it for investors to really chart a path forward?
I don't think it's too difficult now because we've gotten used to all the news going back and forth. And actually, there's some positive news here. Looks like we're going to have maybe like a two-phase detente here where we've got some tariffs perhaps rolling off in December, December 15th. Already some September tariffs have been rolled off. I think we'll continue to see some of this back and forth action, but investors are getting used to this. And remember, we've known all along China has a lot more to lose than we do, so there will be a deal at some point in time, and it looks like the talk of compromise is coming in here. So I think it's becoming less and less of an issue, which is supportive to the U.S. market.
And so as far as the markets are concerned, unless there's a trade deal that's really skewed one way or another, really highly, you're not going to really see it influence the markets much.
No, I don't think so. And I think what we're seeing today is indicating that. You know, we're digesting the highs of yesterday very normal fashion. We had that high yesterday, that new high, which is a 5-month high, breaking the July high. We've gotten that. on higher volume. Today, we even have a little bit higher volume, which is good. All three indices broke new highs yesterday. We've got a little bit of normal profit taking that took place this morning. Transports are on the verge of a new high, which confirms Dow theory rally. We've got over 150 S&P stocks within 2 to 3% of new highs. So this rally is really broadening out. The defensive sectors of utilities and real estate and staples are in retreat. So this all looks very good. I think that investors are normally digesting this and are really starting to pay less attention to what's going on in the trade unless, like you said, we get some kind of a crazy skewed deal one way or another. I don't think it's any news anymore.
Everyone just keeps saying, though, the expansion, it just can't keep going. It has to end sometime. And so they're almost encouraging people to develop more of a defensive posture. The fact is we just don't know when it might end.
No, and what I'd like to see this healthy skepticism out there. That's always good. It means there's probably more room to go. You know, it's been 10 and a half years now that this rally has been going. We've had a nice long expansion, but it hasn't overheated. I think we're a ways from overheating. We've got the Fed now helping us out, which is also a good thing. So I think we've got a good situation unless some kind of surprise comes in, which can always happen, but I don't think that that will happen. The environment this quarter, fourth quarter, is also very different than the environment we had a year ago at this point in time, and people are still feeling the sting of what happened last year in the fourth quarter. So again, there's some healthy skepticism out there.
How's Wall Street feeling about the Fed, not only what the Fed is doing, but what the Fed is saying?
Yeah, they like it. They're applauding it. So the Fed was too restrictive last year. Chairman Powell was saying that they're going to hold quantitative easing on autopilot. And, of course, he reversed course after the Christmas Eve correction. And since then has lowered rates three times. And now they're just on hold, which is good. The market seems to be priced well at a P.E. ratio of 18. And the Fed seems to have settled in here. Perhaps Chairman Powell has, you know, found his place now. And what's good about this is that they're not talking about taking away any more liquidity at this point in time. Now, the problem is there's a lot of liquidity out there sloshing around still, about $4 trillion from our Fed. And then we have other central bankers around the world that are still engaging in quantitative easing. But this is at least good for the market. So I think we've still got a ways to run here. I'm thinking this is kind of like what we're experiencing in Chicago right now in the fall. We've got a pleasant, kind of cool day right here. We haven't had Indian summer yet. So I'm thinking we may get one more push to the upside, one more good rally out of this market within the next 12 months.
A lot of people focus on U.S. companies, which makes a lot of sense. Anything maybe internationally, or at least in general, should that be something that people are paying attention to?
We have been buying international this last year, and it actually looks like in the last month we're starting to see this swing. There's about a 10-year pendulum swing back and forth where international wins and then U.S. wins, and we're talking about the stock trading of the companies and the interest in those companies. So the last 10 years has been a win for the U.S., and now it looks like we're starting to see that turn back to international. P.E. ratios on the S&P 500 about 18, internationally around 12 to 13, so certainly we are not at parity here. This could result in as much as a 25 or 30% rally of international over the U.S., maybe over the next 5 years. So definitely I would be overweighting international. If you're not overweight yet, I would take these rallies as an opportunity to lower U.S. equities and increase international equities.
We touch on this dollar cost averaging. We touch on that a lot. Is it maybe a time to remind people of that in a market that you get a few ups, few downs, but really no significant movement?
Always dollar cost average. The market is always going to be volatile. When we take a look at history, I can't find a period of time where the market isn't volatile. In fact, what's unusual is the last 10 years have been less volatile than normal. So dollar cost averaging, by far, one of the best ways to invest, not only in U.S. equities, but it's a great way to get that exposure to international equities. So rather than trying to time the market and pick that place to just extremely overweight international, I would continue to dollar cost average. That's every month. Put in a fixed dollar amount, come rain or come shine. Don't get scared. Don't get greedy. Just keep setting that money in there every month.
Thanks so much for all the analysis. John Beaver, president of Phase 3 Advisory Services.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Part two of Travel Tuesday, a study by the Food Policy Center at Hunter College in New York and the site DietDetective.com raises questions about the quality of water on airplanes. Let's get into that with Joe Schwederman, professor of public services, director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul. Joe, we do want to dig into that. First, though, help us again with this real ID that we're being told everyone needs. We just talked about it in our last segment. If I just go in and renew my driver's license, I'm not going to get a real ID, right? I have to bring in some other documents. It's just a little more complicated.
Yeah, the Real ID Act put a few strings on it to make sure the identities are real. It's not a huge burden, but you have a new picture taken. You have to demonstrate your address. You can't just walk in, pay your $20, and be out the door. That said, it's just more of a big deal that most people are used to not doing that until their driver's license expired. But October 20th, no boarding a flight, so there's going to be a bit of a scramble.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. Going to be a lot of people at the airport very upset come October of next year. All right, let's talk about water on the planes. Are we talking about drinking water? Are we talking about the water they make the coffee with? Apparently, it's none of it's any good.
Yeah, this is an interesting study. It's really getting some attention because it is pointing to something that's just been below the radar, and the studies show that almost all the airlines have drinking water that's in the unsafe zone. Some of the regional airlines are really low, below 1 out of 10. And the main factor isn't lead or pollutants per se. It's E. coli, bacteria, and so forth. And it's raising some eyebrows because you have most airlines doing bottled water, but people access that water for other reasons. In the bathroom, perhaps making coffee, it's probably going to trigger some regulatory change.
So I was always under the assumption that they made the coffee with bottled water. Apparently not.
Well, it varies by airline. I've been searching this a bit, and international airlines especially are more apt to often use tap water. And so there isn't real clear a policy on that. Certainly, airlines are now charging more for drinks in some cases. You pay for a bottle of water, so people have that incentive, you know, to go to the bathroom and grab a something to quench their thirst there, which is clearly a bad idea here. And I think what happens is you have extreme temperature change among that water. Then you have, of course, water that's not flushed out after every flight. There's precious few examples out there where water isn't taken from a tap through a pipe, but it's stored in a tank. And airlines clearly are one example of that.
Yeah, and certainly that's a list that airlines don't want to be on if they're at the bottom of it, right? I see United Airlines, JetBlue, Spirit, not very happy this is getting out.
No, certainly not. And it's kind of interesting. Alaska, which seems to win all these competitions on best service, came out the best. But United, but especially the partner airlines, you look at Air Wisconsin and SkyWest and Republic, and they're even lower. So there's something about these RJs, regional jet technology water systems that are especially have a red flag now connected with them.
And certainly bring a bottle of water on board, apparently. Thank you. Joe Schwederman, professor of public services, director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.